a city on the other side of it, only a distant forest of twinkling lights. "I've called ahead and booked us a table at the Stork," said the man with the iron-grey eyes, stepping out of the car's driving compartment. "Word is Voronov's going to be eating there tonight, so the place is pretty packed."
"I'm pleased," Sibylline said. "You can always rely on Voronov to add a little gloss to the evening."
Casually she opened a compartment in the side of the car and pulled out a black purse, opening it to reveal little vials of dream fuel and one of the ornate wedding guns I'd seen aboard the Strelnikov. She tugged down her collar and pressed the gun against her neck, gritting her teeth as she shunted a cubic centimetre of the dark red fluid into her bloodstream. Then she passed the gun to her partner, who injected himself before returning the baroquely ornamental instrument to Sibylline.
"Tanner," she said, "do you want a spike?"
"I'll pass," I said.
"Fine."
She folded the kit away in the compartment, as if what had taken place was of no particular consequence. We left the car and walked across the landing deck to a sloping ramp, which led down into a brightly lit plaza. It was a lot less squalid than any part of the city I'd seen so far, clean, cool, and packed with wealthy-looking people, palanquins, servitors, and bioengineered animals. Music pulsed from the walls, which were tuned to show city scenes from before the plague. A strange, spindly robot made its way down the thoroughfare, towering over people on its blade-like legs. It was made entirely out of sharp, gleaming surfaces, like a collection of enchanted swords.
"That's one of Seekward's automata," said the man with the iron-grey eyes. "He used to work in the Glitter Band, one of the leading figures in the Gluonist movement. Now he makes these things. They're very dangerous, so watch out."
We stepped gingerly around the machine, avoiding the slow arcs of its lethal limbs.
"I don't think I caught your name," I said to the man.
He looked at me oddly, as if I'd just asked him his shoe size.
"Fischetti."
We made our way down the thoroughfare, bypassing another automaton much like the first one, except this robot had distinct red stains on some of its limbs. Then we passed over a series of ornamental ponds, where plump gold and silver koi were mouthing near the surface. I tried to work out where we were. We'd landed near the chasm, and had been walking all the time towards it, but it had appeared much closer to begin with. Finally, the thoroughfare widened out into a huge domed chamber, large enough for the 100 or so dining tables it must have contained. The place was nearly full. I even saw a few palanquins parked around one table, which had been neatly set out for diners, but I couldn't see how they were going to eat. A series of steps led down to the chamber's glass floor, and then we were escorted to a vacant table at the edge of the room, next to one of the huge windows set into the chamber's midnight blue dome. An astonishingly intricate chandelier hung from the dome's apex.
"Like I said, best view in Chasm City," Sibylline said.
I could see where we were now. The restaurant was at one end of a stalk, which emerged from the side of the chasm, 50 or 60 meters from the top. The stalk must have been a kilometer long, as thin and brittle-looking as a sliver of blown glass. It was supported at the chasm end by a bracket of filigreed crystal, the effect of which was to make the rest of it look even more perilous. Sibylline passed me a menu.
"Choose what you like, Tanner, or let me choose for you if you aren't familiar with our cuisine. I won't let you leave here without a good meal."
I looked at the prices, wondering if my eye was adding